From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today,
it was almost like an arms race of, you know, who can spend the most on, you know, the local cul-de-sac outside your house.
Why our infrastructure investments are collapsing like a Ponzi scheme.
The infrastructure investments we have made don't actually create enough wealth and enough cash flow for local governments, for states, for counties, for cities, to actually have the money to fix them.
A retired judge teaching police officers alternatives to violent force.
Let's de-escalate. Let's not pull the gun first. Because once you pull the gun, if you're trying to obtain compliance, once you pull the gun, what's the only next level for you? That's to pull the trigger.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it was a mighty close call for Freedom House. The one-of-a-kind Detroit shelter provides housing and legal aid and a host of services for asylum seekers, and its doors were in danger of closing after its annual grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development was slashed by more than half. Freedom House began some fruitful fundraising from the community, but the future was still cloudy for Freedom House until today. And now we've learned HUD had a change of heart and is giving Freedom House its full grant for 2017-2018. But this is a very good time to talk about what Freedom House has meant to asylum seekers. With us is the executive director of Freedom House, Deborah Drennan, and with her is one of the asylum seekers who lives in Freedom House. And to protect her identity and for the safety of her family members back home, we're going to be using the name Susan. And we welcome both of you. So good to have you both here.
Thank you so much.
Deborah, when did you learn that HUD had decided to award you the full grant and not the slash by more than half grant?
We just posted it this morning.
Because it really was looking very dangerous for your future when you heard that the grant was going to be cut so severely.
Yes, we were concerned. We felt all along that we had a good appeal. So when we got notice that we weren't going to be funded, we immediately followed up with the appeal. And we thought we had a pretty good case for it, if you would. And apparently we did.
So they did have a change of heart. Why do you think the grant had been cut?
Well, there's been so much about funding limitations, right? There's only so much money and we're watching it be reduced and reduced. And then priorities shifted about housing and populations, housing first models were what's called transitional housing models. And historically, they weren't the biggest bang for the buck. And when HUD did an assessment, they recognized that. But after meeting with Freedom House, did recognize that we were one of the perfect models. We had a 94% success rate in people exiting our program from homelessness to permanent housing. And even with that, we were prioritized low on the list.
So this was something that HUD has been doing. This did not necessarily begin on January 21st
with a new president. That's correct.
Before we get into the future for you, I want people to get a full understanding of what you do at Freedom House. And that begins by clarifying for everyone the difference between refugees, which is a term we've heard a lot of in the news, and asylum seekers.
Thank you for that. So an asylum seeker is a refugee, fits under the same definition. However, when you think about a resettled refugee, for instance, the Syrians, people coming from the Middle East, those are people who have been vetted, then approved abroad to come to the United States. Now, they don't get to pick a country. You know, there's so many slots, and the UNHCR or whoever's assisting them will direct them to the country that has the space. And for us in Michigan, we have some really terrific resettlement organizations. And so a resettled refugee comes to the U.S., has a Social Security number given as part of that process, and then goes to a resettlement organization and then gets the assistance, connects with job training, English as a second language classes, small funding pot, if you would, for resettlement benefits, which is at risk, to kind of help them get settled. And then these resettlement agencies work with them very closely. Then you have an asylum seeker who is a refugee who really seeks protection on our soil. So their vetting process came through the embassy when the visas were issued. So they come, speaking on behalf of Freedom House, they come with a visa. So they've been vetted, but they don't have a Social Security number. And because of that, they're not eligible for any mainstream benefits. In fact, without a Social Security number, you can't get a job. And so for an asylum seeker, it's illegal. It could jeopardize their case to earn income during the process.
And the process, I'm sure, is not speedy.
No, not at all. Freedom House, a typical case, let's say English-speaking case, could go about 8 to 9 9 months. Then you send that application out. Then there's a receipt. USCIS says, okay, we have your asylum application. Here is your A number. And then the date on that receipt, which then registers them as an alien with the federal government, 6 months later, they can apply for work authorization. 3 months later, it arrives. So 9 months to apply, finish the application, send it in. Then 9 months later, they can start working. So that's about at 18 months.
You can't do anything to bring a dime in. So, boy, do you need a safety net, and that's what you do at Freedom House.
That's what we do.
What kind of services? Besides housing, you have housing.
So housing is critical because remember what we said. You can't earn an income, so where do you live? And we talk about mental health and stability. So without housing, how do you feel safe? We also have the psychosocial services. So we have lawyers right on site who help with the case. 98% of our residents are victims of torture. That includes some children, which is horrible to say, but it's truthful. And so connecting them with medical and behavioral health so that they can pull their lives together and focus more. We have special services for instance, the LGBT community. We recently received a grant from the Hope Fund, from the Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan, to develop some specialized program, reach out to our alumni so that they can also be part of this community that's growing and be connected.
It's a huge umbrella of services.
And employment readiness is key. So we work with some really wonderful folks, one who is a former CEO of Career Builders, Manpower, to really mentor our residents so that they can go off and volunteer in positions. And then ideally they would be hired, but if not, they would have the skills and have an understanding of what the American work culture is.
They broke the ice.
And not forced to take any job available, which in this case oftentimes is survival jobs, because there's some horrible delays in not just decisions, but even being granted asylum interviews and decisions being granted. So people are waiting 3, 5, 6 years. While they're waiting, they still have to support families back home who are in harm's way. So the income has to be sustainable here so that they can live on their own, but also maintain two households.
So you are a huge safety net. And you have, Deborah, you've brought someone with you who is living at Freedom House.
Yes, I did. And Susan, who is from West Africa. And Susan, when did you come to Freedom House?
It was last year in November.
November.
Yes.
So, that's right, because we were driving here from Detroit, and she said, I'll be so glad when things are green. So she's never seen it green here.
It's coming, Susan, I can promise you.
The light is bright. The sun is bright, but no green.
That's Susan, why did you have to leave home?
Mainly for political reasons.
And how did you find Freedom House?
I can say it was really God's way that I found Freedom House. People talked about it. And I got hope when I had just got out of the airport. People found me walking around and were like, what are you doing here? You look lost. So I was like, I'm hopeless. I don't know where to go and I don't know anyone here. Then they were like, can you trust me and I take you home for some few days as I look for a place for you to go? So I was picked up by someone and 2 days later, he brought me to Freedom House.
So you had, talk about the kindness of strangers.
Ambassadors everywhere.
Ambassadors
we don't know
everywhere.
Who they are. And they didn't introduce themselves. They didn't take money. They actually made sure that she got here safely.
They paid everything for me. And they brought me to Freedom House.
So the process is, as you say, a long one to be granted asylum status.
Correct, right. Her first step coming into the house is to meet with the legal department because they have to certainly assess to make sure she's eligible for an asylum claim, because an asylum claim is based on one of five criteria. So you could be fleeing your country because of your religious opinion, because of your political belief, your nationality, your race, or your religious practice. And there's a social group also for the LGBT community. It also could be somebody like a photojournalist, isn't religious, isn't political, but still demonstrating the atrocities in their country. So
and they're in danger.
And
these
they're
are
in danger.
People in
That's
danger.
Correct.
Susan,
being tortured.
What do you think the first thing is? What do you hope to do or do you think about doing once you are granted asylum?
Oh, my God. I don't know. I don't know because I have a lot on my mind. And I had a personal disaster in childhood. So as she has said, that we have organizations that help us to start afresh by finding work to do. And if given the opportunity and I get work to do and I save some money, I'll finance my education further. And I want to become a therapist. So I'm looking forward to that.
Do you have family still at home?
Yeah, I do have a family at home.
Would you like to get them over here?
No.
Okay.
Sometimes the families contribute to the political upheaval. And that's also a very common story that when some families their political divide. I imagine we see that in our country right now. But in that case where you favor the regime, so to speak, and you get more. You get more money, you get more prestige. And those who are outspoken against that regime then become in harm's way, which I think is in Susan's case.
Yes.
Yeah, and the only person I would have brought here is gone.
Okay. So you're building your new life here.
Yes.
Deborah, you've got your HUD grant for 2017, 2018, but you've got to be looking ahead.
Yes.
You've seen President Trump's proposed budget.
Have.
Still a lot of work to do on that, but there's some pretty clear messages for
you, aren't
there?
That's correct. There's messages, I think, for most folks that work in human rights programs. We're looking strategically to prepare for the time when that door is closed. We've had such a wonderful, the wonderful response from the community.
Because you did some big-time fundraising.
$300,000 was raised in less than, just shy of a two-month period when people heard that the threat for our doors to close. And so I think it's important, one, for Freedom House that we have so many allies, some friends, supporters. We've met many new people. I think many of them are going to be and have made commitments to be sustaining donors. But it speaks to the residents that they have friends. When we watch the news and the rhetoric and the fear and the anxiety, that's not necessarily the entire circle that surrounds us, but really strategically looking at those folks. And then as we've built this network of support to keep rolling so that they can introduce us to others, and then eventually to be able to say, which I think the community is telling us right now, remember we told them the government wouldn't help us, right? We lost the funding. And these people stepped up and said, well, we will. And I think we're going to continue with that support. We've had so many calls for volunteers that we actually can't place people. I mean, the calls have been tremendous. Our Facebook page and our website, freedomhousedetroit.org, has all of these special events that people are doing to raise funds, but also because they support the population that we service. They recognize that, you know, refugees, asylum seekers, immigrants have a role in this community, and they want to be part of their development as well.
Deborah Drennan is Executive Director of Freedom House Detroit, and Susan with us today, one of the asylum seekers who is beginning to build her new life in America, in Michigan, at Freedom House. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you. I just can't stop to appreciate and thank the people who have supported us in each and everything, because really Freedom House is a gift to us. They have given us a shoulder to cry on.
Thanks,
and
Susan.
We promise you, it will get green.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Coming up, has our infrastructure development turned out to be a great big Ponzi scheme?
The infrastructure investments we have made don't actually create enough wealth and enough cash flow for local governments, for states, for counties, for cities to actually have the money to fix them.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. To many, it seems like these are very angry, unhappy times in America, in our world. A recently released book offers an antidote. It's called The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. It brings us wisdom from two of the world's leading spiritual leaders, Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. It chronicles a conversation between the two leaders, sharing their stories and best teachings with the hope of creating long-lasting joy and happiness. The book pairs their thoughts with scientific research into happiness. One of the studies in the book centers on the importance of forgiveness and compassion. Last October, I spoke with the Hope College psychology professor who did that study. She's been studying forgiveness and compassion for two decades. Here's our conversation. Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitfleet, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Tell us a little about your history of researching forgiveness. What drew you to it?
I had been drawn to thinking about forgiveness really since I was very young. And I learned the tools of my trade, psychological research, studying emotion and physiology while in graduate school. I was training in a clinical psychology PhD program, and I was working clinically with people who almost always had some sort of interpersonal injustice that had hurt them. So I brought together my training in clinical psychology and my research formation as someone who studied emotion and its physiological elements, and I brought that together with my concern for how people can respond to the relational wrongs and wounds in their everyday lives.
All right. So talk to us about the study that you did that was included in the Book of Joy. Can you give us kind of a simple explanation of the questions you were answering and what you've learned?
Yes, thank you. That very first study we ever did in our forgiveness lab asked people to identify a specific person who they held responsible for having caused a wrong or a hurt in that relationship. They then thought about that specific offense and that specific offender in four different ways. The two unforgiving responses involved sort of remembering, reliving, rehashing, ruminating, as well as grudge holding. On the other hand, we also had two more forgiving responses, one of which involved some empathic perspective taking about the humanity of the offender, and then the forgiveness, which aimed to find even a small way to wish the offender well in the growth, learning, or change that was needed.
Tell us what happened when people focused on the empathy and the letting go and forgiving exercise.
Well, we found many emotional and physiological side effects of that sort of moral response. We found a shift away from negative and toward positive emotion. We found that people were calmer, that they perceived that they were more in control. They certainly experienced more empathy and forgiveness. And physiologically, their faces were calmer. Their brows were less furrowed. The muscles under their eyes were less tensed. Their sweat levels were able to drop off as they do as people become more calm in the laboratory. Their heart rates were less reactive and more calm, and their blood pressure was also less reactive.
That's really, really striking. And did you really see that so clearly? Did it just jump right out at you?
It was undeniable statistically, and we were very happy that another lab in Tennessee, shortly after using a different kind of approach to studying this, found very similar results. And we have since published four experiments that have replicated the effects of what we now call compassionate reappraisal in comparison to rumination about those old hurts.
So in essence, when we keep stewing over those past hurts, we're picking at that emotional scab that keeps us churned up. And then when I think about the Book of Joy, it seems like this is the scientific backdrop to so many spiritual beliefs, such as turning the other cheek or, you know, let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
It's really important, I think, that what we're doing is trying to see more of the truth, not less. We're trying to see the truth of the offender's humanity and have a clear-eyed view of the wrongdoing and its implications. But we also then have the opportunity to see that wrongdoing as evidence that this offender needs to change, to grow, to learn. And even if we can't remain in a relationship with this person because it may not be healthy or safe to do so, we can still desire that good change in the offender.
Well, it certainly is the kind of mindset that belongs in the Book of Joy when you consider these two spiritual leaders, Archbishop Tutu and the Dalai Lama. What does it mean for you personally to be a part of this book, the Book of Joy?
Well, it was such an interesting opportunity because in the year 2010, I had been at the concluding event of a happiness project that had been through Emory. And there were many different interfaith leaders. And so at that time, what was so striking is to realize that interfaith conversations do address areas of common concern, such as compassion, such as forgiveness, but also address those honest areas of difference. And I think in the Book of Joy, you see both those areas of common concern, but you also see the particularities of each tradition shining through. And their friendship shows that they have listened well to each other and can see those particularities, those differences, and those shared areas of concern.
Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitfleet is a professor of psychology at Hope College. Her research on forgiveness and compassion is included in the Book of Joy, Conversations Between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. Charlotte, we want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. A pleasure.
Across our state, across our country, we're talking about infrastructure, how it's failing, what that means, and what it's going to cost to fix the infrastructure problems. But what if the issue with our infrastructure isn't that we're not spending enough, but that we've already spent too much and spent it the wrong way? That's the argument my next guest makes. Chuck Marone is the founder and president of Strong Towns. He's a professional engineer, and he's a member of the American Institute of Certified Planners. Chuck Marone, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Certainly safe to say that word infrastructure is probably one of the most used words of these days, isn't it?
Yeah, you hear it everywhere. And in fact, I've started to hear it in really odd places. Anytime someone gets asked, you know, what should we be doing from a public policy standpoint, you can't escape the word infrastructure coming out. It's like the universal thing we all agree on.
I want to ask you to take just a moment to listen to Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder. This is from his recent State of the State speech.
We're at risk in every corner of Michigan for aging infrastructure, and we cannot take this for granted. Michigan residents deserve safe, reliable, sustainable infrastructure. That's why I created the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission last year. The commission did tremendous work. They looked for best practices not just in our country, but around the world. They concluded that we need to invest more. We need to literally invest billions of dollars of new investment over the next several decades.
So, Chuck, what do you think's wrong with that approach about pumping billions into investing in infrastructure?
It's fascinating because it's conventional wisdom, and it's hard to argue with on its face. When you step back and look at the problem, you can see that, yes, there's a huge amount of infrastructure in the ground. It is deteriorating and it's failing. And the way we fix that problem, if you define the problem as, you know, stopping it from deteriorating, is you spend lots of money. If we actually dig into the problem, what we find is that the infrastructure investments we have made, and really this is a post-World War II condition, the infrastructure investments we have made don't actually create enough wealth and enough cash flow for local governments, for states, for counties, for cities, to actually have the money to fix them. We'll spend, you know, $1 million on a road, and over the course of the life of that road, we won't get anywhere near $1 million back to fix it. And so when you add up everything we built, you see, like, oh my gosh, we have all this stuff out there we need to go out and fix. But if you actually step back and look at, you know, what our return on that investment was, what we actually got for it, it's like pathetically small. And it actually doesn't even justify the expense of going out to fix it.
I love the term you use, growth Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, because for many, many years, the solution to not having enough money to actually fix your infrastructure was you just go build more stuff. You've got a neighborhood that's falling apart and you can't afford to fix the frontage road. So what do you need? Well, you need another mile of frontage road. So you can get another big box store and another McDonald's and some strip malls and some cul-de-sacs with homes on them. And then you can take that money to go back and make good on the promises you made a generation earlier. We're starting to reach the critical end of that where, you know, all Ponzi schemes kind of break down at the end. That's their very nature. We're starting to reach that at the city level and at the state level because we can't generate enough growth to keep it all going.
You actually did a fascinating case study in Lafayette, Louisiana, that proved that that city would have to raise taxes by, what, $8,000 per household just to tread water, just to pay for existing infrastructure?
It's amazing because Lafayette is a fantastic case study. One out of every $5 that the typical Lafayette family makes would have to go just to maintaining the stuff they've already built. So you want the street you drive on to be fixed, you want the sidewalks, you want the pipe to all be there. One out of every $5 you make, about $8,000 more than they're paying now per year, would have to go just to fixing stuff. That's not anything new. That doesn't count, you know, paying for schools or police protection or anything like that. That's just like to fix the pipe. That will never happen. That's an insane number. And so, you know, very much like we have seen happen in cities like Detroit, you're going to have a phase where there's a come-to-grips moment where we can't fix everything. Something's going to go bad. What is that?
Would that case study that you did in Lafayette, would that be representative, do you think, of cities here in Michigan?
Without a doubt. Hmm. The thing that made Lafayette a fascinating case study is that its development pattern is just very post-World War II. It very much captures what kind of a typical American city is. you have an old historic downtown surrounded by kind of traditional walkable neighborhoods, and that was the original city as it existed kind of pre-Depression. After World War II, we started the first highway building phases, and you had the highways run through the middle of the city. You had growth out on the edge. And then in subsequent generations, we've had this kind of horizontal kind of big bang expansion out from the middle. And you see just acres and acres and acres now being developed quite rapidly with single family homes spread far apart.
Yeah, no problem coming up with that scenario in Michigan. What's the solution to this growth Ponzi scheme problem that we've got?
I think it's important when we use words like solution to actually maybe better define what we're talking about. You know, problems have solutions and predicaments have outcomes.
Okay.
And in a sense here, we've grown beyond a problem with a solution and we've created for ourselves some predicaments. I mean, the people in Lafayette are not going to spend one out of every $5 they make on infrastructure maintenance. What it means is that we actually not only have to understand the problem. So, you know, you had the governor on, he was saying how they're going to spend a whole bunch more money. I think that that's fine if we understand the problem. If we don't, we're just expanding it. We're just making it worse. So if local government officials can understand the problem, understand their insolvency, they can start to take the money that they do have and invest it in ways that actually pay a return, will actually, you know, be good investments for the community.
Both President Trump and Governor Snyder have advocated these public-private partnerships, the so-called P3s, as a way that you could rebuild infrastructure and not raise taxes. You think P3s can work?
In short, no. You know, could it work? Yes. But really, the way we're talking about it is wrong. We're talking about it in terms of how do we keep everything we have now and keep it going. What cities have run into, and states too, is that we've run into the kind of this wall of how much we can borrow. You know, we're kind of capped out. If you went back to the early 1950s, cities typically spent about 2% of their budget on debt service. That now, on a national average, is about 18%, and it's growing. And I've seen cities where it's as high as 50%. Those numbers just don't work, and they're kind of endemic of us trying to borrow money to not have to face financial reality. When I was an engineer, I worked on projects like this all the time. We would have, you know, $500,000 a year for maintenance. That didn't get us very far. But if we just borrowed a bunch of money, we could take that $500,000 and spend it on a bond payment instead and then do a whole lot. That's what states have done. What you see now with the public-private partnerships is a way to kind of have corporations borrow the money for you, and then you just, like, lease the stuff back.
So you're not really solving the problem.
No. It's basically like I can't afford to buy a car, you know, and I can't afford a car loan, so I'll go and I'll lease a car instead. Mm. Well, you're still spending the money every month, but you don't have to go through the process of qualifying for a bank loan. That's not solving the problem, no.
Chuck, you have said Detroit could serve as a model for the rest of the country in this. How so?
I say that in a complimentary sense. I think Detroit's an amazing place, and I think what is going on in Detroit right now, while tragic in some ways, is also, you know, beautiful in the kind of emergent properties of just the community relationships that people are developing. Detroit, if we go back, you know, to the early 1900s, is one of the top three, five, you know, cosmopolitan cities in the world. People came from all over the world to go to Detroit. This is an amazing, amazing place. Detroit got started ahead of everybody else. They were kind of the model for the rest of the country and how to use automobile infrastructure to spread your city out and experience very rapid growth. And Detroit has just kind of arrived at the destination of that a lot sooner than everybody else. Detroit has had to deal with those insolvencies. When you look at Detroit today, you see how they struggled, in a sense, on the way down to try to prop everything up. Crazy debt things they took on, the kind of look the other way on some corruption things just because they had to have the growth. If we can avoid those things and learn those lessons and get to where Detroit is now, where I think they're making a commitment to small incremental investments, to neighborhoods, to people on the ground, I think we can avoid a lot of the pain and suffering that we've seen the last two decades in Detroit.
Getting the lights back on.
Yeah.
Low-risk investment.
Well, when you focus on bread and butter instead of dessert, you can actually improve people's lives with a lot less cost. And, you know, Detroit has had to humble itself, in a sense, to say, you know, we're going to focus on these basics and make it all work. And I think they've seen positive results from that.
Chuck, if you could sit face to face in front of Governor Snyder, in front of President Trump, both of whom have talked a lot about investing in infrastructure, what would you say to them?
Well, I'm not a political person, and I kind of struggle.
All the better.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know that there is a pressure to solve these problems now. You know, we see this in, like, the medical profession. You go to a doctor, and if the doctor says, you know, what you really need is diet and exercise, we're like, well, no, I want you to solve my problem now. And it's a little bit like the same thing with our politics. You know, I would tell the governor, I would tell the president, our cities need a lot of diet and exercise. They need a lot of healthy habits. And the more we can do to help them develop that, I think the better they're going to be. I think the more we feed them, you know, monetary sugar high and, you know, keep them from kind of coming to grips with some of these harder decisions, I think the more we're going to hurt them and the more people are going to suffer in the end. A true leader right now today is helping us develop good habits at the local level as opposed to kind of feeding our worst instincts.
Chuck Marone, founder and president of Strong Towns. Chuck, it was great to talk with you and share these ideas. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thanks so much.
Still to come, helping police officers transform that warrior mentality into a guardian mentality.
When you dress someone up as a warrior, they're going to act in accordance.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new police training program offers a hope of changing the basic mindset of so many officers, the so-called warrior mentality that's been at the root of deadly confrontations between police and the people they're arresting. The University of Michigan Dearborn Office of Metropolitan Impact is offering this unique police training program through their current policing curriculum series. They're hoping to help patrol officers transform the warrior mentality into a guardian mentality. This program was created by a former judge who'd served for 25 years on the Washtenaw County Circuit Court. Now he's director and associate professor of the Criminology and Criminal Justice Program at U of M Dearborn, Judge Donald Shelton. Welcome. Good to have you here on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
And with him is the co-director of Alternatives to Violent Force. Juliet Roddy is a health economist at U of M Dearborn. Juliet, welcome.
I'm happy to be here, Cindy.
Judge Shelton, what was the inspiration for this police training, or should we really say retraining program?
I think it is retraining. The inspiration was what we see happening now on television, on the internet, and the incidents of police violence. The reality is we don't have any more police-involved shootings than we've ever had. The difference is that we always assumed that the police were being honest in their reports when they said that those shootings were justified. Now a thing comes along called a video camera, and we all have one on our little phone here. And now the public is seeing incidents where it didn't happen that way, and it looks like the police are using lethal force when it's not necessary. What that's resulted in is a tremendous lack of confidence and trust in our police.
Mm-hmm.
Research indicates that our police are now held in lower public esteem than they have been since 1993 in the Rodney King incident.
That's pretty stunning.
We need to change that.
We do, because in order for police officers to do the jobs they need to do, within the communities, there has to be trust and a better sense of back and forth with the community.
The community policing agencies have had a difficult time recruiting new officers into the profession as well. So it very well could result in a shortage of police officers. Most agencies will report that they have open positions that they cannot fill right now with street police officers.
This warrior mentality that we were talking about, where does that come from?
Well, it's actually part of police training, and there's nothing wrong with police having part of a warrior mentality. That warrior mentality includes and emphasizes honor and duty and resolve, and most importantly, a willingness to engage in righteous violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that mentality has infused all of our police training. What we're trying to do is to add a guardian mentality to that so that the police also understand that one of their duties is protecting civilians from unnecessary indignity and certainly from unnecessary harm. Sometimes police have to have a warrior mentality to keep themselves and keep the public safe, but they also need to approach their job with the idea that what I'm really here to do is make sure that everyone walks away from this incident safely.
And so often when you think of police interactions with civilians and tensions are high, somebody may be high, somebody may be mentally ill, and then, well, talk about what we've seen, kind of recap, because that's where this warrior mentality is causing trouble.
You know, one of the things we have trained police to do, and they often do, is reach for that gun early on. And what they do is they pull the gun, that firearm, and they're doing it to get compliance. They want the person to comply with their orders.
Basically say yes, sir, and do what they're told
and
to
do.
And
if you or I are confronted with a gun being pointed at us, our rational response is, yes, sir, whatever you need. But in most police confrontations that result in violence, the person isn't acting rationally. They are either mentally ill or they're under the influence of alcohol or some other drug so that they don't respond rationally.
Such as, case in point, the young man we saw in the Chicago police shooting who was kind of flopping around in the middle of the street outside the fast food restaurant. That's kind of case in point.
Exactly, exactly. There was an incident in Bakersfield, California, where a 73-year-old man who was suffering from some dementia was shot 7 times by a police officer on a report that he had a gun. There was never a gun seen, and in fact, in his pocket they found the crucifix that a bystander had reported was a gun. That response ends up escalating an incident instead of what we try to teach, which is let's de-escalate. Let's not pull the gun first. Because once you pull the gun, if you're trying to obtain compliance, once you pull the gun, what's the only next level for you? That's to pull the trigger.
Juliet, as a health economist, what's your take on this?
So as a health economist, it's a broad role for health, right? Death is the end of health. So this is an effort at prevention, which we know is the most cost-effective way to approach health problems. And we're trying to get at the root source, which is the interaction with police and community. We could approach it from the community side, but there's too many community to try and address in their safe interactions with police. So we're trying to approach it from the officer's side. We're trying to do a cost-effective program of prevention, targeting a root source at an people that we have access to, which are the police. And they've been very cooperative. They've helped us design the program. They've been our partners all along, and they willingly come to the courses.
How long do the courses last? What kinds of things are you doing to kind of basically change the mindset from that initial training they've received or perhaps years of being on the street?
Well, the program is 7 3-hour sessions weekly. We try to limit the number of officers to between 20 and 40 so that we can interact with them personally. We talk, first of all, about this idea of the warrior and guardian mentality. I talk about how the law regards the use of force and about how the public perceives now the use of force. We try to teach de-escalation as a first alternative. Sometimes I say to police officers that maybe the best weapon you have in your arsenal is your tongue. That is your ability to talk, especially calmly, and bring the situation down. Use distance, use cover, those things to de-escalate a situation rather than escalate it. We also bring in speakers to give them an understanding of the African-American culture because police officers deal with people from different cultures. We also have a speaker who talks about the Arab American culture. And we also spend some time talking about what are called the Terry stops, these stop and frisks, and the whole concept of profiling and how that can be perceived by the public and end up in a violent situation when it didn't need to be. We talk about how to interact with mentally ill persons and persons who are under the influence. And finally, I guess permeating all of our training is this concept of the sanctity of human life, to try to reinforce what these officers already know, to reinforce that everybody's life matters. Yours is the officer, the defendant who's standing here, the perpetrator who's standing in front of you, and the general public. All of those things are important. You know, when I was on the bench, one of the things that was on my mind always was that there was a person standing in front of me, and I was about to make a decision that was going to dramatically alter several lives. It was going to dramatically alter the life of that defendant. It's going to dramatically alter the victim's life and could dramatically alter the safety of the community and the lives in the community. That's an awesome responsibility. The police officer on the street finds himself in exactly that same situation, that the decision that police officer makes may change the life of the person standing in front of him. It may change his or her own life, and it certainly may impact on the public safety. Understanding that broader approach to how we deal with law enforcement and justice, which are not necessarily the same, is very important.
There's been such a national awareness, growing awareness of the militarization of our police departments. And I just brought up on my laptop here a photo for us to talk about. And it was a photo that went around the world. It happened during a Black Lives Matter protest in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's 28-year-old Aisha Evans. She's wearing a sundress. She's gazing straight ahead with a very, very calm expression and facing a line of police officers who are armed to the teeth, and two officers wielding guns are approaching her as if she was aiming a gun at them, and she is just the model of serenity. What do you both take away from that? It's really become an iconic photo. What do you take away from that?
Well, certainly when you look at the photo, you can see the militarization of the police. There are a number of police lined up in gear, and the police that are approaching the young woman are in gear. So when I look at the photo, I understand that when you dress someone up as a warrior, they're going to act in accordance. So I do want to make sure that everyone understands that this isn't a path that the police have chosen on their own. This is policy oriented, and we've steered them in this direction, militarizing them into believing that the public is at times their enemy, even this innocent, beautiful young girl. And the police are aware of that, too. The curriculum that we've designed, we didn't come up with these ideas all on our own. These are ideas that came from the Police Executive Research Forum. We took their 30 guiding principles and converted it into a university seminar series because that is what we can do. But they know what's been done to them. They understand, but as long as we keep gearing them up and providing them with military-style implements to do their job, sometimes you act accordingly.
We have equipped them to deal with the worst possible scenario, and certainly police may face those scenarios. They have to worry about terrorism. They have to worry about the fact that our society is probably the most armed in the world now and that maybe everybody has a gun who's approaching them. But when we equip them to deal with the worst possible scenario, the most dangerous scenario, how do they deal with that when it's one-on-one with a citizen like this person who is unarmed facing them? They're preparing for the worst. And being a police officer is a tough job. The nature of policing requires that officers run toward rather than away from danger. It requires that they use force if necessary to protect the public.
And I suspect years and years of seeing awful things and people at their worst can alter. I mean, you come into the academy maybe with shiny, bright ideals, and the reality of seeing awful things and, as I said, people sometimes at their very, very worst, that has to change them.
It jades you, right? If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So a doctor sees health and illness and danger in poor health habits. Everywhere he goes, a police officer sees danger and potential dangerous situations everywhere he goes because he's exposed to that, he or she.
Now, how will you know if this training is successful?
Well, I told our first group when they graduated that I know going through this course made some of them angry, defensive, resentful at times, because they were being confronted with some difficult things in their lives and they feel put upon. But the goal was to get them thinking about it. The goal was to get them to think in a bigger perspective about what their role is. Sure, they may not like seeing videos and they may say, well, that's not us.
I wouldn't do that.
And I understand that. And the reality is that most of them would never do that.
What would happen in classes if you say, would you blow the whistle on that person? What would happen then?
We had a big discussion about that.
What do they say?
Well, I wouldn't stick up for him is generally the response. But when you have a paramilitary organization, which is what the police are, the whole ethos is to pull together, to protect themselves. And while they would not say good things about an officer who did those things, they would hesitate to come out publicly. We had the incident in Southeast Michigan we all saw in Inkster, where the officer beat a driver 16 times and caused some serious injuries. And our officers and the public watched that video. And to some extent, their response was, yeah, we would never do that. And I said, well, if you were called by the prosecutor to testify against him that is not proper police procedure, would you do it? That's a challenge.
It took them a while to answer that. They were stunned.
That's a challenge. But we're not going to change attitudes and behavior dramatically in 7 weeks session. But what I hope we can do is get them to think about and be introspective about how they respond to situations and how they feel when they find themselves in such a confrontation so that maybe they'll act differently. What's the measure of success? Mine isn't very academic, Cindy. My measure of success is that if we, as a result of all of this, if we save one life, and I don't necessarily mean an innocent life, if we save one life, our program will have been successful.
And you will probably never know because it won't make a big headline. So I suppose, in a sense, you are sending them off. Now, here's what I'm wondering. Who is this available for and how can they find out more? Is it departments that sign up officers? How does it work?
Well, so far, that is how we've done it. We've enrolled cohorts of officers all from the same department. However, in our second cohort, which is beginning January 4th, we are starting to mix departments already. It's advertised clearly on the University of Michigan Dearborn website. The training is called Alternatives to Violent Force. Don Shelton, Julie Roddy, our names are associated with the program, or you can search the University of Michigan Dearborn website. And we're allowing open enrollment. A number of agencies have expressed interest, and even guardians of jails and security officers have been interested in the training. So we've had broad interest. Michigan State Police have expressed interest as well.
So much work to be done.
If you go to the U of M Dearborn website and just search for AVF, as in Alternatives for Violent Force, our webpage will pop up.
Judge Donald Shelton and Associate Professor Juliet Roddy, University of Michigan, Dearborn, and it's the Office of Metropolitan Impact presenting Alternatives to Violent Force, part of its current policing curriculum series. It was great talking with you both. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on, or issues, or people that you want to know more about? Just let us know. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. You can go to michiganradio.org and click the link that says Stateside, or you can email us stateside@michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroff. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.